6. Rarities. 38 notable uncollected and unpublished short stories and other works. Many typical, i.e. non-fanatical, no offense, Stephen King fans and constant readers think that whatever King has in the stores and on the bestseller lists is the sum total of his output. The truth is that King is, and always has been, very prolific, and there are uncollected and unpublished works out there that sometimes show up in a collection or as a bootleg online. This feature is a look at a few of these rarities. Special thanks to my friend, the late Rocky Wood, for his exemplary work in tracking down many of these obscure works. Also, when deciding which rarities to discuss in this book, I went with stories about which there is some known information, such as title, plot, and/or theme. When all we know is that there was a story written by King decades ago and it isn't available anywhere, I skipped it. See my book, The Lost Work of Stephen King, for more on Stephen King rarities. Volume 1 is available from the Overlook Connection Press. Volume 2 is in the works. People, Places, and Things, Volume 1. This early collection of typed stories has on its cover page, first printing, 1960, and second printing, 1963. It was discovered by Stephen King or a member of his staff in a box of papers, and the 19-page collection includes short stories by King and his then-friend, Chris Chesley. The story, Never Look Behind You, was a collaboration between King and Chesley. Here's a look at the stories by Stephen King in the collection. The Hotel at the End of the Road. Two hoods on the run end up paralyzed in a museum of the living dead. The clerk tells them, "You'll be well-preserved, and you won't die." This marked King's first use of zombies, and the hotel seems to foretell King's later masterful use of haunted places, especially the Overlook Hotel from The Shining and the Marston House from Salem's Lot. I've got to get away. A robot becomes suddenly conscious and tries to flee the assembly line at the atomic factory where he works. This story is an early example of King's frequent motif of out-of-control technology. See Christine, Trucks, The Mangler, Word Processor of the Gods, The Tommyknockers, Obits, for example. See The Killer in this volume. The Dimension Warp. This story is listed on the contents page of People, Places, and Things, but does not appear in the collection. No known copies of it exist. From the title, though, it's pretty clear it's a science fiction story. The Thing at the Bottom of the Well. This is a very important early Stephen King story. A sadistic little creep named Oglethorpe ends up at the bottom of a well. His body is found with his arms and legs pulled off, just the way he used to pull the wings off of flies, inflict other tortures on animals, and deliberately try to hurt people. He ties a rope across the stairs so the maid will trip and fall into the cellar. It is one of the earliest, if not the earliest, use of King's archetypical thing-in-the-sewer monster that later became Pennywise in It. The monster under the bed, the boogeyman in the closet, this thing at the bottom of the well, appears to be the ancestral grandfather of all these fiendish King bad guys. Stephen King has never allowed The Thing at the Bottom of the Well to be republished, although, interestingly, he did allow his one-page story, The Hotel at the End of the Road, also from the People, Places, and Things collection, to be published in the 4th, 1993, and 5th, 1996 editions of The Market Guide for Young Writers, published by Writer's Digest Books. The Stranger. Kelso Black, one of the bad guys from The Hotel at the End of the Road, kills a guard during a robbery and is then visited by a stranger who seems to be Lucifer himself. The stranger tells Black that he created a contract with him when he murdered the guard and he's there to cart him off to hell. This seems to be King's first use of the Dark Man, a personification of evil, who would later become Randall Flagg and other RF manifestations in The Stand, The Dark Tower series, and The Eyes of the Dragon. I'm Falling. This story is listed on the contents page of People, Places, and Things, but does not appear in the collection. No known copies of it exist. In the foreword, however, we're told the Let Stephen King's I'm Falling transport you into a world of dreams. The Cursed Expedition. Two astronauts are eaten by Venus, which, to their horror, they discover is alive. This story is one of King's first uses of the idea of being consumed by a living planet, a fate that later also proves to be the fate of Rand in Skeleton Crew's Beach World. Also, he uses Venus as the villain, which he will do later in I Am the Doorway. The Other Side of the Fog. A sudden, unexplained fog becomes a time machine and poor Pete Jacobs keeps running through the whiteness trying to get back home. Just as Night Surf was an early forerunner of The Stand, The Other Side of the Fog is an early precursor to The Mist. Never Look Behind You. A man who had been picking the people's pockets clean of money for years is visited by a woman in rags who kills him with a flash of fire to his throat. Two men later discover the dead George and one says, "I'm glad he's gone." The story ends with the line, "That one was lucky. He didn't look behind him." The Village Vomit. King talks about this satirical spin-off of the high school newspaper The Drum in his essay, Everything You Need to Know About Writing in 10 Minutes. When I was a sophomore in high school, I did a sophomoric thing which got me in a pot of fairly hot water, as sophomoric didos often do. I wrote and published a small satiric newspaper called The Village Vomit. In this little paper, I lampooned a number of teachers at Lisbon Main High School, where I was under instruction. These were not very gentle lampoons. They ranged from the scatological to the downright cruel. Eventually, a copy of this little newspaper found its way into the hands of a faculty member, and since I had been unwise enough to put my name on it, a fault, some critics argue, of which I have still not been entirely cured, I was brought into the office. The sophisticated satirist had by that time reverted to what he really was, a 14-year-old kid who was shaking in his boots and wondering if he was going to get a suspension, what we called a 3-day vacation in those dim days of 1964. The guidance counselor arranged what he no doubt thought of as a more constructive channel for my talents. This was a job. Contingent upon the editor's approval, writing sports for the Lisbon Enterprise, a 12-page weekly of the sort with which any small-town resident will be familiar. King credits the paper's editor effusively. This editor was the man who taught me everything I know about writing in 10 minutes. His name was John Gould, not the famed New England humorist or the novelist who wrote The Greenleaf Fires, but a relative of both, I believe. Speaking of everything you need to know about writing in 10 minutes, here are 10 tips King offers to aspiring writers. Be talented. Be neat. Be self-critical. Remove every extraneous word. Never look at a reference book while doing a first draft. Know the markets. Write to entertain. Ask yourself frequently, am I having fun? Learn how to evaluate criticism. If it's bad, kill it. The Pit and the Pendulum. According to Rocky Wood, King wrote The Pit and the Pendulum, which he and Chris Chesley sold copies of at Durham's elementary school. It novelized the 1961 movie of the same name. All trace of the story has been lost. King talked about this story in Douglas Winter's Stephen King, The Art of Darkness. One day, I went to Brunswick to see the American international film of The Pit and the Pendulum with Vincent Price, and I was very impressed by it, very, very scared. And when I got home, I got a bunch of stencils, and I wrote a novelization of the movie, with chapters and everything, although it was only 12 pages long. I bought a ream of typewriter paper, and I bought a stapler and some staples, and I printed, on Dave's machine, about 250 copies of this book. I slugged in a price of a dime on them, and when I took them to school, I was just flabbergasted. In 3 days, I sold something like 70 of these things, and all of a sudden, I was in the black. It was like a license to steal. This was my first experience with bestsellerdom. But they shut me down. They took me to the principal's office and told me to stop, although there didn't seem to be any real reason. My aunt taught in that school, and it was just not seemly. It wasn't right, so I had to quit. Also see Trigger Finger and The Undead in this section. Triggerfinger and the Undead. In Stephen King, Uncollected and Unpublished, Rocky Wood discusses these two lost stories. A possibly unique piece of King ephemera appeared on eBay in late 2012. The seller offered a one-page flyer Stephen King had created to advertise stories from his cottage publishing venture, Triad Publishing Company. This was also the name King used to publish People, Places, and Things, 1960 and 1963, and The Star Invaders, June 1964. The flyer was posted to a fellow fan in New York and is postmarked 5 p.m. 6 September 1963 at the Pownall, Maine Post Office. It advertises three stories for sale: King's print adaptation of the American international film The Pit and the Pendulum, Triggerfinger, and The Undead. Rocky also reproduced the full text of the flyer. All punctuation and formatting is as original. Dear Monster Fan, the crypt has just opened, and we here at Triad are letting out three of the most monstrous tales to come your way in a blue moon. Here they are. The Undead, a chilling excursion into the twilight world of vampires, terror, and the undead. Here's a sample. Madly tumbling over each other, the kids piled back into the rod. One didn't make it. His head was split open like a ripe melon. The rod peeled out, spotlighting one of the horrors in the glare of its headlights. It skidded. 20 pages of terror. A Triad classic. Only 35 cents. Triggerfinger. What happens when a trigger-happy intelligence agent invades Castro's Cuba in search of a beautiful U.S. space scientist? Plenty. Only 20 cents. The Pit and the Pendulum. This is not Poe's classic. It's adapted from the AI Shocker, starring Vincent Price. What's it about? Torture, premature burial, and the shambling horror that walked the darkened corridors of the storm-ravaged castle. Also, only 20 cents. These horrors are brought to you by Triad Inc. They are guaranteed to shock or your money back. So get on the hearse and read these terrors on the way to the crypt. Yes, I want to be scared out of 10 years' growth. Send me the Triad horrors I've checked. The Undead, 35 cents. The Pit and the Pendulum, 20 cents. Triggerfinger, 20 cents. Send to Triad Publishing Company, care of Steve King, RFD No. 1, Pownall, Maine. Enclosed payment with money order, please. Wood continues, when queried about Triggerfinger and the undead, King said, I don't remember either one, which isn't surprising. Around the time I discovered famous monsters, spacemen, creepy, and eerie, those stories just poured out. The Star Invaders. The Star Invaders is a 17-page short story in TypeScript that King wrote when he was in his teens and which he self-published as a Gaslight book when he was 17. The text is spaced at 1.5 lines and the sheets measured 8.5 by 5.5 and is one of King's earliest short stories still extant. Dr. Michael Collings said of The Star Invaders, the great strength of the story is its nascent characterization coupled with an occasional image that would resonate through much of King's fiction. The story includes a scene that foreshadows the closet scenes in Carrie, as well as the tiger scene in Here There Be Tigers. Lord, they had locked him in a small room. It seemed even smaller than before. Jerry felt a cold sweat break out on his brow. He remembered back 30 years. He had been a kid then, a really small kid. His father had been a bear on discipline, and every time he'd done something wrong, he was locked in the closet to meditate. He had gotten to hate that closet. It was small and stuffed with clothes. The arid smell of mothballs made him cough, and to his terrified 4-year-old mind, it always seemed that a tiger crouched in the corner. Another important image from The Star Invaders is the green light associated with the aliens invading ships. King would later use green fire as an image for evil in both The Eyes of the Dragon and The Tommyknockers. Codename, Mousetrap. This short story was originally published in The Drum, the Lisbon High School newspaper, on October 27, 1965, under the byline Steve King. It has not been reprinted. King was 18 when it was published. In Stephen King, Uncollected, Unpublished by My Dear Friend, the Late Rocky Wood, we are treated to a detailed synopsis of this story. In this America Under Siege story, a man breaks into a supermarket with a recently installed burglar alarm. The burglar, Kelly, becomes somewhat wary after reading BJ Burglar Alarms had installed a new burglar, also misspelled burglar, alarm. The bottom of the note read, Codename, Mousetrap. It was a very large store. 20 cash registers full of Friday night receipts faced him blankly. Suddenly, a buzzer sounded and the lights came up, causing Kelly to run for it. With that, the soup display began to move. It clattered toward him, spilling individual cans and revealing the glitter of stainless steel beneath. Now he could clearly see the shape of the mousetrap. 3 limber-jointed steel tentacles snaked out at him. An insectivorous row of TV eyes stared at him. In the silence of the store, he could actually hear the clitter of the relays in its electronic brain. As he ran from the creature, he could not believe what he saw, and when he did, he let out a small moan. Dozens of beefsteaks were rolling over the meat counter and coming after him along with a rump roast with 2 glittering antennae that crashed into his leg and clutched him with bright steel claws. 98 cents a pound, he thought wildly. My rump roast certainly isn't as cheap as it used to be. Dodging a V formation of sirloins and a shopping cart waving tentacles like a wild Medusa on wheels, Kelly crashed through a plate glass window and onto the pavement. His arms dripped blood, and he picked jagged shards of glass out of them numbly. But I made it, he thought, getting up. I made it. And then the parking meter grabbed him. As Wood acknowledges, this story utilizes a favorite theme of King, technology coming alive and manifesting a murderous instinct. Other examples of King's use of this theme include Christine, Trucks, The Mangler, and The Tommyknockers. I Was a Teenage Grave Robber. This was Stephen King's first published story. King was 18 when this thriller first appeared in a 1965 issue of Comics Review. It was published the following year, 1966, in Stories of Suspense as In a Half World of Terror. I Was a Teenage Grave Robber, with its fabulous classic 50s B-movie title, is the story, in 9 typed single-space chapters, of young Danny Jared, a destitute orphan who is recruited by Rankin, emissary and assistant to mad scientist Stefan Weinbaum, to work as a grave robber. There are some interesting elements in this story that foreshadow later King images and works. In an early harbinger of King's magnum opus, It, King has Danny Jared musing about the nightmares of childhood as he enters the Stygian blackness of Weinbaum's garage. All my childish fears of the dark returned. Once again I entered the realm of terror that only a child can know. One memorable passage from the story. A huge, white maggot twisted on the garage floor, holding Weinbaum with long suckers, raising him toward its dripping pink mouth from which horrid mewing sounds came. Veins, red and pulsing, showed under its slimy flesh and millions of squirming tiny maggots in the blood vessels, in the skin, even forming a huge eye that stared out at me. A huge maggot, made up of hundreds of millions of maggots, the feasters of the dead flesh that Weinbaum had used so freely. In a 1973 essay, The Horror Writer and the 10 Bears, King revealed his top 10 list of personal fears. His number 1 bear was fear of the dark. This story also contained one of King's earliest uses of the image of a rat, specifically in the line, "I was cut off by a sound that has haunted me through nightmares ever since, a hideous mewing sound, like that of some gigantic rat in pain." It was actually the sound of a giant maggot. In this tale, King also uses the adroit and appropriately kingish image of the velvet darkness of the night. The Invasion of the Star Creatures. King talks about this early story in On Writing. King states that he wrote and self-published 48 copies of this short story in the summer following 8th grade. He sold around 43 or 44 copies of the story during summer vacation. Happy Stamps. King talks about writing this story in On Writing. The idea came to him after his mother stuck her tongue out at him, and he saw it was green from licking S and H stamps. It was written circa 1959, 1960. I thought how nice it would be if you could make those damn stamps in your basement, and in that instant a story called Happy Stamps was born. The concept of counterfeiting green stamps and the sight of my mother's green tongue created it in an instant. The hero of my story was your classic poor schmuck, a guy named Roger, who had done jail time twice for counterfeiting money. One more bust would make him a three-time loser. Instead of money, he began to counterfeit happy stamps. Except, he discovered the design of happy stamps was so moronically simple that he wasn't really counterfeiting at all. He was creating reams of the actual article. In a funny scene, probably the first really competent scene I ever wrote, Roger sits in the living room with his old mom, the two of them mooning over the happy stamps catalog while the printing press runs downstairs, ejecting bale after bale of those same trading stamps. "Great Scott," Mom says. "According to the fine print, you can get anything with happy stamps, Roger. You tell them what you want, and they figure out how many books you need to get it. Why, for 6 or 7 million books, we could probably get a happy stamps house in the suburbs." Roger discovers, however, that although the stamps are perfect, the glue is defective. If you lap the stamps and stick them in the book, they're fine. But if you send them through a mechanical licker, the pink happy stamps turn blue. At the end of the story, Roger is in the basement, standing in front of a mirror. Behind him, on the table, are roughly 90 books of happy stamps, each book filled with individually licked sheets of stamps. Our hero's lips are pink. He runs out his tongue, that's even pinker. Even his teeth are turning pink. Mom calls cheerily down the stairs, saying she has just gotten off the phone with the Happy Stamps National Redemption Center in Terre Haute, and the lady said they could probably get a nice Tudor home in Weston for only 11,600,000 books of Happy Stamps. "That's nice, Mom," Roger says. He looks at himself a moment longer in the mirror, lips pink and eyes bleak, then slowly returns to the table. Behind him, billions of happy stamps are stuffed into basement storage bins. Slowly, our hero opens a fresh stamp book, then begins to lick sheets and stick them in. Only 11,590,000 books to go, he thinks as the story ends, and Mom can have her tutor. King submitted Happy Stamps to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. It was rejected with a note wishing him luck with the story. It has never been published. The 43rd Dream. This rhyming short story, discovered by one of Stephen King's high school teachers, first appeared in the Lisbon High School newspaper, The Drum, on January 29, 1966. The byline was, "Steve King." Lisbon High teacher Prudence Grant discovered the story in her files as she was preparing to retire, and ultimately sold the only known copy of the newspaper on eBay for $416. In an interview on NPR, Grant spoke of King being taunted and pranked when he was in grade school and noted that several characters in Carrie seemed to have been modeled on Lisbon High faculty and staff members. The story itself is beyond strange. It completely fits the title, although Dream could justifiably have been replaced with Drug Trip and it would have worked to describe the events of the story. A description of the story that appeared in Justin Brooks' Stephen King, A Primary Bibliography of the World's Most Popular Author, reads, "A high school student tells about being abused by a cross-eyed police officer of looking like John Wilkes Booth, being beaten by a crowd with hula hoops, and getting served at a bar by bartender Jack the Ripper." A Possible Fairy Tale. A Possible Fairy Tale is an anti-Vietnam War essay that King wrote in 1970 when he was a student at the University of Maine. This essay appeared in the May 8, 1970 issue of the University of Maine's student newspaper, the Maine campus's special publication, The Paper. The paper was an attempt by some UMO students to call attention to the war in Vietnam and to the Nixon administration's refusal to acknowledge the strong resistance of many Americans to our involvement. The front page of the paper had a peace sign as part of its masthead, and the entire front page was taken up by photos of an anti-war rally. These were the 11 elements of King's fairy tale, paraphrased. 1. Friday, May 8, 1970. The University of Maine joins the nationwide campus strikes against the war in Vietnam. 2. Saturday, May 9th. 1 million people participate in an anti-war sit-in at the White House. 3. Sunday, May 10th. The White House sit-in swells to an astonishing 1.2 million people. 4. Monday, May 11th. The campus strikes continue. All the members of the Teamsters Union decide to strike until President Nixon withdraws our troops from Cambodia. 5. Tuesday, May 12th. National Guard troops refuse to enter Berkeley campus. 12 platoons of Army troops and Marines refuse to go to Cambodia. 6. Wednesday, May 13. The members of the United Auto Workers Union join the nationwide strikes. There are calls for Vice President Spiro Agnew's impeachment. 7. Thursday, May 14. President Nixon addresses the nation and pleads for support. Rail workers join the strikes, while the sit-in around the White House grows to 2 million people. Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy, who had been strongly opposing the Vietnam War since 1968, describes the activities so far as a groove. 8. Friday, May 15th, a bill is expected to pass the House today, forbidding President Nixon to spend any more money in Southeast Asia. 9. Saturday, May 16th, postal workers, dock workers, and some federal government employees join the nationwide strikes. There is talk that articles of impeachment against Spiro Agnew will be drawn up by Thursday, May 21st. 10. Sunday, May 17. President Nixon tells the nation that he is withdrawing 500,000 troops from Vietnam and that the Cambodia invasion is over. 11. Monday, May 18. Soviet Premier Alexei Kozhikhin calls Nixon and congratulates him on an act of sanity and humanity. The two leaders decide on a summit to discuss complete disarmament. A ceasefire in Vietnam on January 28, 1973, ended our direct involvement in Southeast Asia. The last U.S. troops left Vietnam on March 29th of that year, but we continued to bomb Cambodia while retrieving American prisoners of war. Queen of Spades. This presumably lost short story was written by King as an assignment in Ted Holmes' writing class when King was in college. In 5 to 1, 1 in 5, King said it was hugely influenced stylistically by William Faulkner and that it was the only short story for which he received an A+ while in college. Slade. Slade is an 8-installment, 6,500-word comedic novella, a parody of the traditional Western by Steve King, that King wrote while attending the University of Maine and which was published in the Maine campus during his final semester and in the summer following his graduation. The original copies of the Maine campus in which Slade appeared were stolen from the university's library sometime in 1988 or 1989. Slade is comedy by Stephen King. It is about Jack Slade, a gunslinger with a grim face and two sinister 45s. Slade's guns are always described as sinister. As our story begins, Slade is in mourning for his lost love, Miss Polly Peachtree of Paducah, Illinois, who has been killed in an untimely accident. A flaming Montgolfier balloon crashed into her barn as she was milking her cows. The King Family and the Wicked Witch. The King Family and the Wicked Witch is a short story King wrote for his children in 1977, and which he later gave to a college friend who was then editor of a Kansas newspaper, The Flint. The story was published in the August 25, 1977 edition of the paper. The original title of this story was The King Family and the Farting Cookie. The story begins, on the secret road in the town of Bridgeton, there lived a wicked witch. Her name was Witch Hazel. The King Family and the Wicked Witch is very funny and contains some real-life King family details. King mentions the family's red Cadillac and blue truck, and he writes that the mommy was writing poems and cooking. There are a couple of Stephen King-esque images in this brief children's tale. King writes that the witch would see the mommy reading Joe a story, and her bony fingers would itch to cast a spell. In Thinner, the gypsy man's bony fingers do cast a terrible spell on Billy Halleck. Also, the character of Dom Cardozzi in this story could be seen as yet another Thinner foreshadowing, this time in the character of Italian mobster Richard Ganelli. Before the play and after the play. Before the play is the initially unpublished prologue to The Shining. It recounted the early years of the Overlook Hotel. This prologue was published in two versions, the version in the August 1982 issue of Whispers magazine and the version in the April 26 through May 2, 1997 issue of TV Guide magazine. The TV Guide version is an abridgment of the original Whispers version. King wrote the following in an essay to accompany the Whispers publication. I liked the prologue so well that I could feel it wanting to become a book itself. Enough energy from the novel I had just written to make me feel as if I had just landed a powerful jet, which still has enough fuel to take off again and do a few loops, power turns, and barrel rolls. The feeling of my editor at Doubleday was that both the prologue and most of the epilogue could be cut, with the result that we could offer the book at a dollar less than if we included them. They would have brought the page total of The Shining to over 500. I agreed willingly enough, and although I don't regret the decision, I'm pleased that Stuart Schiff has elected to publish the prologue here. For the curious, the only part of the epilogue which remains in the book is the final chapter, set in Maine during the summer after the events at the Overlook. The TV Guide publication was to promote the upcoming miniseries The Shining, written by Stephen King and directed by Mick Garris. After the play is the initially unpublished epilogue to The Shining. For years, it was believed to have been lost, but it was discovered and included in the special 2017 edition of The Shining, published by Cemetery Dance. Skybar. Skybar includes the opening and concluding segments of a horror short story to which the reader contributes the middle section. King wrote Skybar for the book The Do-It-Yourself Bestseller, which provided the reader/writer with the beginnings of a horror story and the final line, the first time he had ever contributed something so unusual to a book. King authority Dr. Michael Collings wrote that Skybar suggests it, as well as demonstrating traditional King stylistics and techniques, brand names, and a painfully precise realism as a backdrop for fear. Several other well-known writers participated in the Do-It-Yourself bestseller, including Isaac Asimov, Erskine Caldwell, Robin Cook, Irving Wallace, Ken Follett, William F. Buckley Jr., Barbara Taylor Bradford, Steve Allen, John Jakes, Alvin Toffler, and Colin Wilson. All contributed story fragments which the reader then had to complete. For the Birds. For the Birds is a comedic short short King wrote for a pun-laden anthology. For the Birds is a very short and very funny piece which King describes as a science fiction joke. He wrote it for a collection titled Bred Any Good Rooks Lately? In which well-known writers, including Annie Dillard, Roy Blunt Jr., John D. MacDonald, Lawrence Block, Peter Straub, Robert Block, and others, all wrote short stories that ended with an absolutely horrendous pun. Editor James Charlton liked King's so much that he used it for the title of the book. Synopsis. By 1995, the air in London has gotten so bad that the rooks, an old world bird related to the American crow and similar in size and color, are dying off and jeopardizing London's tourist trade. The London City Council hires a guide to breed rooks in Bangor, Maine, a city with a similar climate to London's, but without the pollution. The startup materials for the Bangor-based North American rook farms were two cases of rook eggs. The rook raiser was paid $50,000 a year by the London City Council to raise rooks so that London would not become a rookless city. Since the Brits are especially eager to bring new life to their tourism business, they send the Downeaster a telegram every day which reads, "Bred any good rooks lately?" An Evening at God's. An Evening at God's is a one-minute, one-act play King wrote in 1990 to benefit the American Repertory Theater's Institute for Advanced Theater Training. The entire play consists of 2.5 typescript pages and was auctioned off at the Hasty Pudding Theater on Monday, April 23, 1990. An Evening at God's takes place in God's living room. King was part of an elite contingent of 15 writers tapped to contribute plays. Other literary luminaries participating included Art Buchwald, Don DeLillo, Christopher Durang, John Kenneth Galbraith, Larry Gelbart, David Mamet, David Rabe, John Updike, and Wendy Wasserstein. King did a lengthy interview with Gail Caldwell that ran in the Boston Globe on Sunday, April 15, 1990, a week before the auction. The two-page talk was titled, "Stephen King, Boogeyman as Family Man," and in it, King discussed the benefit and his play. In King's Boston Globe interview, he discussed a novel he wanted to write. "What I'd like to do at some point in the next year, this has never really let go of me, is to write a novel about Jonestown. In Guyana in 1978, the fanatical and messianic religious leader Jim Jones coerced 911 of his followers into drinking Flavor Aid laced with cyanide. In An Evening at God's, God mentions by name Alan Alda, Robin Williams, and Richard Pryor. The last line of the play is, 'My son got back, didn't he?'" Jonathan and the Witches. This is one of the first short stories Stephen King ever wrote. Dr. Michael Collings, in his massive bibliography, The Work of Stephen King, describes this piece as the earliest story King ever wrote, emphasis added. King wrote this tale when he was 9 years old for his Aunt Gert, who would pay him a quarter for every story he wrote. "Naturally, I inundated her," he writes in the introduction to Jonathan and the Witches, in First Words. Jonathan and the Witches is 545 words long, and the first page of the manuscript is reproduced in First Words. Jonathan and the Witches is a classic Grimm's-like fairy tale, and truly a significant work for someone so young, as well as being a sign of what was to come. The Killer. This short story was originally published in the spring 1994 issue of Famous Monsters in Filmland. It has not been reprinted. There are a couple of versions as to how this story ended up in print. King's version is that he submitted it to Forrest Ackerman, editor of Spaceman magazine, and that it might have been the first story he remembers ever submitting. Ackerman kept it and, according to King, showed up at a book signing and asked King to sign the manuscript of the story, which King did. Ackerman's version is that he read part of the story to King during King's visit to his house and asked him to guess who wrote it. He then revealed to King it was his own story, and King granted permission to Ackerman to publish it in Ackerman's magazine, Famous Monsters of Filmland. In this story, a robot working on an assembly line suddenly becomes conscious and attacks one of his fellow robots. The PA blares the alarm, "Killer! Killer! Killer!" and the story ends with one of the guards at the factory saying, "One of them turns killer every now and then," as they take the killer away. The killer is a reimagined version of "I've Got to Get Away" in People, Places, and Things. See the section on that story in this chapter. The Old Dude's Ticker. This short story, which King calls a crazed revisionist telling of Poe's The Telltale Heart, was published in the Nikon 20 commemorative volume in 2000. Only 333 copies of the booklet were printed. King writes that The Old Dude's Ticker was one of the stories that did not sell to the men's magazines in the 2 years after he was married, 1971-1972. The other was a modern-day revision of Nikolai Gogol's story, The Ring. King's version was called The Spear, and it is lost. The Old Dude's Ticker updates the Poe story to the Vietnam era. Thin Scenery. This short play's first appearance was in the summer 2017 issue of the literary journal Plowshares. There's a lot to like in Thin Scenery, and it is likely we will be hearing about small theater group and school productions of this play. What is real and what is delusional? These are the questions Stephen King asks in the play, and he's particularly good at it. He establishes a reality and then makes us question it. All of it. Like, maybe that TV is something we can put our hand right through. Or maybe that wall is cardboard. Or not even there. Or maybe a child is not who her father believes she is. This is a chilling, multiple-viewpoint story that literally makes you question, who's the audience? Who are the actors? Who are the characters? And is the play even really happening? Early on, the psychiatrist says, "There's a difference between perception, which is subjective, and empiric reality, which is not." Yes, there certainly is. Whimsy. Whimsy comprises 15 pages of manuscript in typescript consisting of the first chapter, 14 pages, and the first page of the second chapter of a proposed Lord Peter Whimsy novel Stephen King was thinking of writing in 1977. In the summer of 1977, Stephen King and then-editor Bill Thompson, he acquired Carrie, discussed the possibility of King writing a novel using British novelist Dorothy Sayers' character of Detective Lord Peter Whimsy. This was at a time when King was preparing for a fall move to England for a year's stay that ended up lasting only 3 months. King and his family ended up renting a furnished house at Moorlands, 87 Aldershot Road, Fleet Hants, in the country of Hampshire for £50 a week. This relocation, abridged, as it ultimately was, would result in King's collaboration with Peter Straub on The Talisman. In the first chapter of King's novel, Lord Peter Whimsy and his faithful manservant, Bunter, are on their way in Lord Peter's Bentley to Sir Patrick Wayne's estate on the day before Halloween. Rain is coming down in torrents, and the fog has begun to creep up, making driving even more difficult. Lord Whimsy is depressed. His beloved Harriet died during the German Blitz of England. His friend Salcom, Sally Hardy, had also recently died. Miss Clemson, a beloved member of his office staff, was suffering through her final days in a hospital, and now he was on his way to a dinner party he most definitely did not want to attend. As they drive through the English countryside on a potholed road also dotted with shell craters, the two men cross a terribly rickety bridge, and Lord Whimsy asks Bunter to pull over so he can relieve himself. While waiting for his master, Bunter hears Lord Whimsy urgently call to him. Bunter ventures out into the rain, where he learns that Lord Whimsy has discovered that the supports on one side of the bridge they just crossed have been cut halfway through with a hatchet. Suspicious now, they get back in the car and continue on their way to Sir Patrick's estate. Suddenly, Bunter announces to Lord Whimsy that their vehicle no longer has any braking power. The two men end up crashing into a tree, and the first chapter comes to a violent conclusion. The Leprechaun. The Leprechaun is a 5-page short story in manuscript that King wrote for his son, Owen, and which he planned on someday expanding into a novel. It ends with no resolution, so these pages may actually be the first chapter of the planned novel. The story was written when Owen was 5 and tells the story of Owen's attempt to protect a real-life leprechaun that was living in their front lawn from the family cat, Springsteen, a sly feline who liked to eat things. He had had his eyes on Owen's guinea pig, Butler, for quite some time, and who also liked to play with things before he ate them. King had written 30 pages of this story longhand in a notebook when he lost the precious pages off the back of his motorcycle somewhere in New Hampshire during a Harley-Davidson trip from Boston to Bangor. Keyholes. Keyholes is an unfinished short story, or possibly the opening scene of a novel, consisting of 2 1/2 handwritten pages from a loose-leaf notebook. The text comprises 26 paragraphs and 768 words. Keyholes is one element of a collection of oddities found in a spiral-bound notebook that King initially donated to the May 1, 1988 American Repertory Theater benefit auction, and which has since traded hands several times on the secondary collector's market. The Stephen King notebook, as the notebook has come to be known, contains the unfinished keyholes, several notes from King to himself and his wife Tabitha, King's handwritten revision of the screenplay for his film Silver Bullet, based on his novel Cycle of the Werewolf, and page after page of King solving algebraic equations by hand. What there is of keyholes is brief. The entire segment appearing in the notebook takes place in the office of a psychiatrist named Dr. Conklin. Dr. Conklin is preparing for a session with a construction worker named Michael Briggs, a troubled man who wants to talk to the good doctor about his son Jeremy. The character of Michael Briggs is very reminiscent of another Stephen King troubled father character, Lester Billings from King's seminal Night Shift short story, The Boogeyman. Phil and Sundance. Phil and Sundance is an unfinished 80-page novella Stephen King wrote in 1987. One page of the manuscript is online, and it begins chapter one titled Phil and the Thing on the Stairs, with "There were a lot of things the kid didn't like." There is a handwritten note on the first page of the manuscript. "Jesse, this is what I wanted your opinion on. I don't know if grown-ups will let kids read it, but is it any good? Draw me a line with your honest opinion. Steve King." Comb Dump. This is a 41-page incomplete manuscript for a mystery short story discovered by Rocky Wood during his research at the University of Maine's Stephen King collection. This manuscript is set in a Maine psychiatric hospital and is undated. The story is about a young cocaine addict who checks into a rehab program with a comb that is missing teeth. The comb begins to heal itself, inexplicably replacing the missing teeth, and we're off to the races. Rocky Wood said it was highly unlikely King would ever return to the story and complete it. George D.X. McArdle. This is a 123-page partial novel stored in the Special Collections section of the Raymond H. Fogler Library at the University of Maine at Orono. George D.X. McArdle is a comic western that King never finished. It is believed to have been written sometime in the 1980s. A multi-page, very detailed synopsis of the 123 pages of the manuscript is available in Rocky Wood's Stephen King, Uncollected, Unpublished. But Only Darkness Loves Me. This short story, of which only two pages exist, was written with King's eldest son, Joe Hill. The first part of the story, there's no way of knowing if there were more parts intended, is called The Most Beautiful Girl in the World. The opening scene is of a boy talking to a girl in a bar in Ledge Cove, Maine, whose beauty is so something she can only be looked at indirectly. I Hate Mondays. This story was written with King's son, Owen King. It is a completed story, 5 pages long, and along with But Only Darkness Loves Me, is in the Special Collections section of the Raymond H. Fogler Library at the University of Maine in Orono. This story can only be accessed with Stephen King's written permission. Squad D. Squad D is an 11-page, 2,000-word, unpublished Stephen King short story. It was written by King for Harlan Ellison's The Last Dangerous Visions anthology, a collection originally scheduled for publication in the late 70s. Harlan Ellison had this to say to George Beam in the first edition of George's The Stephen King Companion about Squad D. "Stephen sent me a story for Last Dangerous Visions that needs to be rewritten. The problem is, when you say, 'I'm going to talk to Stephen about rewriting, I'm going to make suggestions,' it sounds as if you are trying to blow your own horn. Well, here I am, the smart, clever fellow who's going to teach Stephen King how to write. Well, I don't mean any such thing as that. What I mean is that I was sent a short story, and I think there's a lot more in it than Stephen had time to develop. The story deserves better, the work deserves better, and Stephen's reputation deserves better." Dr. Michael Collings, writing in his The Shorter Works of Stephen King, has this to say about Squad D. Squad D is a story of guilt and forgiveness, of peace growing out of turmoil. Josh Bortman finds the peace he has sought among his only friends. Dale Clouson becomes reconciled to his son's death and to the tragedy that took the lives of too many sons. While not a particularly dangerous vision, Squad D does deserve to be seen. With The Reach, it is one of King's most penetrating statements on the relationship of life and death, and the tenuous border separating them. In December 2017, it was reported that Squad D would be officially published for the first time in Volume 8 of Publisher Cemetery Dance's Shivers series, edited by Richard Schismar, co-author with King of Gwendy's Button Box. Remembering John. Remembering John is Stephen King's moving eulogy for John Lennon, written shortly after Lennon's assassination on December 8, 1980, and published in the Bangor Daily News 5 days later. King begins this memorial with a slurry of no-nonsense facts about what John was not. He was not the first ex-Beatle to have a critical success. George's All Things Must Pass album won that race. He was also not the handsome former Beatle. We all know that award goes to Paul. And John wasn't a movie star like Ringo was. But somehow, for me, King writes, he was the only ex-Beatle who really seemed to matter. From the essay, "Lennon was a cynic, a poet, a sarcastic son of a bitch, a public figure, a private man. And he had his fans, like me, who looked at the paper on the morning of Tuesday the 9th of December and then sat down hard, unable to believe it at first, and then, horribly, all too able to believe it." The Null Set and the Insanity Game. These are the typed manuscripts of two Stephen King short stories, an unpublished science fiction short story, The Null Set, and an unpublished short story, The Insanity Game, that came into my possession through the generosity and good graces of a major Stephen King collector. Lori, it isn't often that Stephen King gives stories away for free, yet on May 17, 2018, King released the new short story, Lori, on his website as a PDF. King tweeted, "I'm posting a brand new short story. If you want to read it, think of it as an appetizer to the main course, The Outsider, coming next week. The story is free. Read, print, share, whatever. Enjoy." Widower Lloyd Sunderland gets a puppy which he names Lori. They go for a walk down 6 Mile Path by the water one day and come upon a horrifying sight involving his neighbor and an alligator. Any more would be giving away the ending, but I will provide one small spoiler for animal lovers who have yet to read the tale. Lori lives. The Turbulence Expert. Stephen King's most recent short story as of this writing, summer 2018, is The Turbulence Expert, which appeared in the 2018 Cemetery Dance anthology, Flight or Fright, 17 Turbulent Tales, edited by Stephen King and Bev Vincent. The story is about people who have the capacity to literally believe they are going to die in a plane crash, a psychic power which allows the plane to survive in horrific turbulence. King refers to them as precognates, which harkens to the precognates Agatha, Dashiell, and author in the 2002 film Minority Report, and their ability to see future crime. The movie is based on the 1956 short story of the same name by Philip K. Dick. These turbulence experts are paid incredibly well and are given their assignments by someone they know only as the facilitator, a man with a slight lisp on the other end of the phone who none of them ever meet. The story recounts one particular flight on which Craig Dixon does his job, but also may have found a way to retire early. The Turbulence Expert could be categorized as science fiction, and I have always been a big fan of Stephen King's science fiction. He doesn't let us down, pun intended, with his latest effort.